Welcome to the Triumph Hour. I'm Melanie Davis. This show is based on the message of the Triumph Book, which is a collection of stories from people who have endured severe tragedies and who have found purpose and joy in life because of them. The Triumph Hour is created to give hope to anyone struggling through adversity. The featured guests will do this by sharing light, wisdom, and the wonderful gifts which have come to them as compensation for overcoming their tragedy. This is a reward and increase to our lives which we can all hope for and obtain as we learn to share our light with others. The theme of today's show is You Keep What You Give Away, which is a line taken from the opening song of the program you just heard. I will play the full song for you at the end, so be sure to stick around. This is the maiden voyage of the Triumph Hour, or the first program to be recorded. So I thought featuring the music of the theme would be a fitting introduction. While enduring painful difficulties and tragedy, it is often compared to darkness closing in around us. It can be hard to see past the pain and loss, and it is natural to feel negative or even angry as we wade through our afflictions, disappointments, or losses. But there is a silver lining, a profound truth which can effectively chase away the shadows when we are ready. Whether we realize it or not, in the midst of the greatest darkness, we are actually gathering light in the form of wisdom and growth. As Helen Keller once said, character cannot be developed in ease and quiet. Only through experience of trial and suffering can the soul be strengthened, ambition inspired, and success achieved. Or as William Ellery Channing stated, difficulties are meant to rouse, not discourage. The human spirit is to grow strong by conflict. So as we grow strong from conflict, we are able to reach our highest potential. It is an interesting and true paradox that we make our longest strides towards greatness through adversity. In the opening theme music, the lyrics state, "Take the light from your pockets and return it to the skies above. You can't take it with you, but you keep what you give away." True greatness is not something selfish, but rather it is the ability to help others along on this mortal journey we all share. Until we offer our knowledge, compassion, love, and wisdom, which we have gained through our adversities, it is as if we are keeping it all tucked away in our proverbial pockets. Such wisdom and light is meant to be shared, and as we do, the purpose for what we have endured is magnified. Today, we have a very special guest. She is someone who has overcome more than her fair share of adversity, so much so that she actually was able to write two stories for the Triumph Book, each being completely unique to the other in depth of tragedy and height of reward. Today, we will be hearing from Rhonda Knuth. Thank you so much, Rhonda, for being our first featured guest on the Triumph Hour.
Thank you for having me today, Melanie. It's a real honor to be with you and to share my story with your audience.
Oh, I'm so excited to have you here. I'd like to start our discussion today by having you share a little bit about one of your most difficult experiences. So tragic, in fact, that you were in the media quite a bit many years ago talking about it.
I was, Melanie, and it was opportunities that, looking back on now, I really do cherish. I was able to be on a number of television programs, the 700 Club, Sally Jesse Raphael, Phil Donahue, and Inside Edition. And in addition, I told my story, and a book was written about it by Rocky Mountain News reporter Kevin Flynn.
So, Rhonda, if you would you please share your story today and the light that you've gained from all that you learned as you endured and overcame your difficulty?
I'd be glad to. You know, Melanie, when this first happened in my life, I felt that it was the end for me and that my life had absolutely been destroyed. And though it's taken a number of years for me to find healing, I have been able to turn what was a very much a negative thing in my life and turn it around and make it a very positive thing in my life. On Valentine's Day in 1975, I married my then husband, Eddie, in a ceremony in Denver, Colorado. First couple of years of our marriage was relatively happy. We had two children, Paul and Diana, and he joined the Navy, and we became a bona fide military family. Our initial duty station was in Norfolk, Virginia, and it was while we were there that my husband, Eddie, started having problems. He was never a cruel or unkind man. He was a very gentle soul, at least as far as I knew him to be. But he was gone a lot while he was in the military, and he just began to dabble in drugs. And these are all things that I found out after the fact.
So what were some of the first signs that he was changing?
You know, I think that it was that he, again, the withdrawal from the family and the isolation and not participating when he was home with us and wanting to be gone a lot. It was while he was in Kingsville that really my story begins to develop. He, right as we came into town, there were a number of rapes that were occurring in the town, and Kingsville is a very small town. And so for the rapes to be occurring in the town were very unsettling for the folks. We hadn't been there very long when two different men were arrested, and you could almost hear the town breathing a collective sigh of relief, and things kind of settled down. And then the rapes started occurring again, and it really threw the little town into a tailspin. I remember being just vaguely aware of what was going on because I was really more concerned about my marriage at that point. But he had begun to just seriously isolate from us. He was drinking a lot, and I could smell especially marijuana on him many times. And so I was just really concerned about what was going on in our marriage. In November of that year, on my way to work one morning, I prayed and I said, God, I don't know how to fight an enemy that I can't see. And I need to know what's going on in our marriage. And so would you show me what it is, even if it hurts to know?
Wow.
My children, Paul and Diana, were 3 and 5 at the time. And it was just a very unsettling time for us. My home is in Denver, Colorado, and so I was a long ways away from family support. And I just felt very, very much alone. On Christmas day that year, we had a really good Christmas. I remember Eddie, my husband, sitting by the Christmas tree and putting the bikes together on Christmas Eve for the kids. And it was just a really pleasant time. And I thought, well, whatever's going on must have, you know, run its course. And he's going to turn and do better now. However, 3 days after Christmas, he was arrested. I had was working that day, and I had taken the children to the daycare. When I got off of work, I came home, picked up the kids, and came back home. And they were playing outside, and I was cleaning up the house. I was a little miffed at him because he worked nights, and I worked days. And we kind of shared the household chores, and I was really tired that day. And I came home to find the house in the same state that it had been in when I left that morning. And so I remember cleaning, and the telephone rang, and it was Captain Gomez from the Kingsville Police Department. And he told me that they had picked up Eddie and that they were questioning him in the rape and kidnap of a 16-year-old girl in town.
What was your reaction to hearing that?
My initial reaction was almost one of irritation. I thought, this is the last thing that we need. And, of course, they're, again, falsely confusing, you know, him with someone else, accusing him, and that they must have...
It was kind of denial initially.
Exactly, exactly. And that was probably the only way that I could deal with what we were fixing to go through. So the captain told me, he said, we have your husband. Would you like to come down to the police station and pick him up? Or would you like for us to bring him home? I didn't want to take Paul and Diana down there and have them see their dad come out of the police station. And so I said, well, if you would, please just bring him home. They brought him home and... came in, told me a little bit about what was going on, that they suspected him in this rape, and then they told him, don't go anywhere, and they left. We discovered later that, of course, during that time when he was at home, before they came back to arrest him at a later stage, they had talked with the girl that had been raped and with them, were gathering their facts and making certain that they had the right man. We had gone to bed that night. I put the children in bed, and Eddie and I went to bed, and he just, settled right in, and I said, I think that we should pray, and so he prayed something about God being near us during that difficult time, and he rolled over and went to sleep. And Melanie, that seemed to reinforce my initial thoughts that, you know, he wasn't guilty. If he really had, he must not be worried about it. If he really was concerned, how could he just roll over and go to sleep? We hadn't been in bed very long when the police knocked on the door, and I got up and answered the door, and they said, we have a warrant for your husband's arrest. And he came out. They handcuffed him, read him his rights, and took him away. I didn't know what to do.
So were the children in bed at the time?
The children were in bed. Yeah, it was later in the evening. The children were asleep, and I I did not know where to turn. I called my parents, of course, and told them what was going on. But they were, many, many miles away from where we were at. I called our pastor and his wife, and they said that they would be right over. And they did come immediately and were there with us. And the pastor's wife ended up spending the night with me and watching the children while my pastor and I went down to the jail to try to speak with Eddie. And again, when I had the opportunity to talk to him, he shared with me that he was innocent, that he remembered the day very clearly, that he had gone shopping for my Christmas present, had come home, and had taken a nap before I went to work. And the only thing that really threw me a curveball was he said, we have a gun, which I didn't know we had, and he said, I want you to get rid of it.
Oh, my.
I didn't feel like I could do that, and so I changed it to a different location, but that was the best I could do. And I thought, when
so you did hide it for him?
When the police come, they're going to find it. So I went back home, and, through the night, I got a couple of obscene telephone calls, so it was obvious that people were hearing the news already and that the little town Grapevine was going full force. The next morning when we got up, my pastor's wife had to run and do some chores, and so I was there with the children, and Paul was 5 at the time. And he came into the bedroom, and he looked at me, and he said, where's my daddy? And I made a decision in that moment that I was going to be as honest with my kids as I felt that they could handle for their age. So I pulled Paul up on my lap, and I hugged him close, and I said, honey, daddy's not here. And he totally blew me away when he said, well, I thought I heard you tell my uncle during the night last night that my daddy's in jail. I had called and spoken with Eddie's older brother and had told him what was going on, not having a clue that Paul was awake or that he had heard anything. So I just held him and I said, honey, daddy is in jail. And he said, what did he do? And I said, he did some things that the police think he shouldn't have done. And daddy says he's not guilty. And he looked at me and he said, did he do those things? And I think for the first moment, I really had some doubt. And I said, I don't know, honey. I just don't know. It took the kids to their daycare that morning as if it were just any other morning. And when I came back home, the police were already in our house. They had come through an open living room window, and they had rangers standing on the front lawn with guns. And it was very scary. And the police captain, of course, was there again, Mr. Gomez, and he said that I could go into the house, but no one else could go with me. And so I went inside, and I sat down on the couch in our living room, and I watched as they dismantled my home. They went through everything, and the captain handed me a copy of the search warrant, and I read it over, thinking all the while, there is no way that he did these things. And I was sitting there, and I heard some commotion at the front door, and I looked up, and one of the officers was bringing a beautiful 16-year-old girl through the front door. And in that minute, in that moment, I hated her because I thought, what are you doing? Why are you saying these things about my husband when there's no way that he could have done them? They asked me to move off of the couch so they could take some pictures because at one point they said he had brought her back to our home and had raped her there by the Christmas tree under the picture of the children. So I got up and I went into the little bedroom that Paul and Diana shared, and I sat down on the edge of the bed and I started to cry, and I thought, God, what's going to happen to us? Our life is just falling apart, and I don't know what we're going to do. And the captain came into the bedroom and he said, if you're hiding any evidence from us, we're going to file charges against you. And then he said, maybe it's your faith. I see a lot of Christian books around here, and maybe your husband just couldn't live up to that standard. And then he said, no, I know what it was. He said, you made demands of your husband in the bedroom that he couldn't fulfill. And
he said that to you?
He did.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's why I think that from that moment on, I took onto myself blame that really was not mine to carry. But I began to think even the authorities think that somehow I'm the one who caused him to do this, if indeed he did do it. And so that, I took that on to myself. And though I would never say that a rape victim and what I experienced are one and the same, but I felt a lot of the emotions that I think a rape victim does feel. I felt incredible shame. I felt anger. I was depressed. I felt that I had been betrayed. Come to find out, Eddie actually had committed the rapes. Not only had he raped this one young girl, but he had also raped a number of other women, possibly going back to when we were stationed in Norfolk. I was not allowed to leave town initially because the police thought that I was involved, and so I called my parents and had them come from Denver to pick up Paul and Diana and get them out of town, and I moved in with my pastor and his wife for a couple of weeks. It was a very, very unsettling time for me. It was very scary. One day I went to the jail to visit him, and I met the captain, and he told me that I was free to go, that they had cleared me, and that if I wanted to leave and go be with my children, that I would be able to go and be with them. So I talked to Eddie that day, and he had finally admitted to me that indeed he was guilty, and I remember saying to him while he cried and I cried, why did you force yourself on a little girl you didn't even know when you had a wife at home who loved you desperately?
Oh,
and at the time, you know, Melanie, I really thought that rape was a crime, was some kind of a sex crime, when in reality, that was just his weapon of choice. What he really wanted was to control. He had a lot of rage going on inside of him, and rape is just what he chose to do to be able to hurt these women. And he managed to hurt the children and I incredibly.
Was he ever violent towards you?
He was never violent toward me or the children, which I think made it especially difficult for us to be able to wrap our arms around what he had done.
Yeah.
So I left and I came back to Denver, and I lived with my folks and tried to put the pieces of our lives back together. He agreed to a plea bargain, and as a result, he was given a 30-year sentence. And he served 10 of those years, got out, reoffended, and is still in prison today.
Oh, wow.
Oh. Yeah. So to say that my life was shattered is kind of minimizing exactly what happened.
Yeah.
I had never known anyone who had ever gone through an experience like that. And my heart was just, I didn't even know where to begin. And so I
started. So how did you start to find your life again?
Yeah, I started by, what I really needed was for someone to gently pull the story out of me and let me tell them what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to a pastor. The second time I went to him, he said, you're like the prodigal son, Rhonda. You've sinned, but now you've come back home.
Oh, my goodness.
And so again, I heard Melanie, blame. Oh, this is my fault.
I'm the one
who caused this to happen. It was several years before I shared again with anybody, and this time it was a pastor's wife, not his wife, though I think they maybe deserved one another. But she told me, you shouldn't talk about these things because as you do, you relive them. And so once again, I heard someone that I respected say, I don't want to hear it.
Can I just stop there and just comment on that? Because that is just the opposite of what people need to do when they've been through a difficult time or a tragedy. The more we talk about it, the more we heal. So that instruction not only was trying to keep you quiet from sharing something that you were hurting from, but it was just false information in terms of what would make you heal.
Absolutely.
To not share our stories is unnatural. Mm-hmm. We need to share our stories.
Sure. I think that I began at that point doing something that was not healthy for me and took me many years to begin to undo. But I began to stuff my pain.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned at the beginning of the broadcast, you know, we have been through some other experiences that were very painful. And what I chose to do rather than to take a chance that someone was going to blame me or that I wouldn't be heard was to just take each package of pain and wrap it up real pretty and put it on a shelf in the closet of my heart. And I did that year after year with the things that happened. I just would take it, wrap it up pretty in case anybody looked in there to see, all they would see was pretties. And, I kept doing that instead of taking the time to really be able to share with somebody the hurt that I was experiencing. But one day I went to put another package in the closet and I opened the door and everything came tumbling out. And I knew at that point I was going to do one of two things. I was either going to take my life because of the incredible pain that I was experiencing, or I was going to begin sorting through those packages and taking the time to really deal with what was inside of them.
Wow, that's a pretty intense point to reach.
Yeah, it was a very hard thing for me to do. You know, I scoured the bookstores when I first came back to Denver looking for a book, any book that would tell the story of someone who had been through an experience similar to mine, someone that would give me some hope that I really could get through this and get to the other side still intact, and I couldn't find anything. So I couldn't find anything that would, help give me guidance as I went along the way. And I had a wonderful family. My mom and dad and my brothers and their families were just incredible, but they were hurting too. And they loved Eddie. And for them to see what he was doing to us was very baffling to them as well. And none of us knew what to do with this pain. The people at my church, I think they were afraid of saying or doing the wrong thing, and so what they did was to cut a wide path away from me, and,
yeah.
and they wouldn't come up. And what I really needed, because Melanie, I hadn't been through it before, and I didn't know what to do either, I didn't need them to try to fix my problem. I just needed them to love on me, to give me a hug and say, I love you, and for them to acknowledge that they knew that I was hurting.
Yeah.
But with the exception of maybe a couple of people, that just didn't happen. And that's so important when we're going through something like that, is just to have somebody acknowledge that we are hurting.
Yes.
There was a quote that I heard early on in the process that I really pulled to my heart, was something that theologian William Barclay said. He said, endurance is not just the ability to bear a hard thing, but to turn it into glory. And so I determined early on that I was going to be one of those women who did make it through. And when I got to the other side, I was going to help other women who were going through experiences that were similar to mine. And so I began journaling big time. That was the way that I began to process what was going on in my heart. Even though I know that I could have talked with my folks, again, they were hurting. And so I just would pour myself out into my journals. I would write my prayers. I would write my concerns, my fears, my everything went into my journals. And that was one of the most important things for me to be able to process the pain that I was in.
Well, you had a listener finally that wasn't telling you that this was your fault.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Now, not that that listener could give me any solutions.
Yeah, you needed some feedback too. Did you find someone eventually that you
know,
could talk to?
Many years down the road, I did, and I think it took me much longer to heal from this than it needed to.
Uh-huh.
But there were some things that I discovered along the way that, you know, I would make notes on in my journal about that really did, looking back in retrospect, were really helpful to me. One of the things was that I learned to watch for some good things among all of the bad. I remember a lady at church coming up to me the first Sunday that I went back. I don't even know who she was, and bless her heart. Someday I hope God rewards her for what she did. But she just handed me a bottle of bath oil and said, I think you're going to need this in the days to come. And it just meant so much to me, number one, for her to acknowledge my pain, and number two, for her to know that I was going to be hurting and that I would need a soothing bath in order to settle down sometimes. So,
you know, it's such a small and simple gesture, too, mm-hmm. and it can mean so much.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, we don't have to do huge things for people for them to have huge comfort from us.
Exactly right. At one point, I determined that I was not going to spend the rest of my life being the rapist wife.
Yeah.
That this was just a chapter. This was only a part of the story of my life. It wasn't the whole thing, and it was not going to define me for the rest of my life. And I think that that was important. When you go through something and you experience intense shame, it's easy for you to let that be the controlling factor in your life, for it to be the thing that says, this is who I am.
Right.
And I was not going to be the rapist wife.
But how did you redefine yourself?
How did I redefine myself?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was as I began to sort through that pain, you know, with the journaling. Eventually, I began to speak and at women's groups, women's retreats, maybe luncheons, those kinds of things. But as I did begin to share my story, and at first it was extremely painful to do that, but as I did that, I began to see who I really was and that I was not just a survivor, I was a victor. You know,
yeah.
I had moved beyond just being the rapist wife, and now I was me. And I do remember in the very beginning thinking, I don't even know who I am anymore. I have no clue who I am. One thing that I think was very helpful was a neighbor man came. He's a writer for the news, and I mentioned him early on and asked that if I would let him tell my story in a book that he was going to write. He, in addition to writing for the newspaper, he also wrote true crime stories, and so I said yes, and he asked me going into it, do you think if he'll...
He was your neighbor?
This was a neighbor, huh?
That's amazing serendipity.
His wife had told him my story, and he...
Wow.
He said, I would like to tell your story. And he asked me early on, do you think that you've healed enough that this won't be really traumatic for you? And I was like, oh, sure. No, I'm doing fine. And I wasn't doing fine. At one point in the book, we did have to return to Kingsville. We went through court records.
Oh,
and
wow.
I read a lot of things that I didn't know
wow.
about what had happened and what Eddie had been doing. I also got to go back to the home where we were living, and the lady that was living there let me come into the house. I got to go to the pastor's house where he had been living at the time, and they had allowed me to come and stay with them. And the people there, again, very graciously allowed me to come back into the house. I think going back and facing that pain, as hard as it was, and I cried a lot of tears while I was there, I think that facing the pain and really looking at what had happened was very healing for me. It's kind of like when you get a splinter in your finger and it festers if you don't get it out.
Yeah.
And it hurts to take it out. It hurts to touch it. But once it's out of there, then the healing can begin to come. And so I think that was a big part of me finding out who I was and beginning to figure out, again, who I am. That was huge for me.
You talked about sharing your story. Do you find that you really were able to find yourself as you reached out to others?
You know, I was, and I wouldn't be honest with you if I didn't say that the first few times I shared it were excruciating for me.
Mm-hmm.
I would get all hot inside and just choke up and think, I can't do this. But as I began to meet other women who were hurting, and I began to get feedback that what I was saying to them was helping them in their own pain, eventually I was able to share and just talk and answer any questions that they asked without it throwing me into a tailspin. I wanted to be the woman that would say to these women, you can get through this. I didn't have anybody to tell me that.
So in a way, you were really learning to live for other people, because if you succeeded, they would succeed too.
That's exactly right. That's
yeah.
exactly right. On one of the, I mentioned early on that we were able to do some television programs, and I remember when we went to do the Sally Jesse Raphael show, there was a young woman on the program with me, and at this point, it was a few years down the road from the rape for me, but for her, it had been 1 month. Her husband had raped a neighbor, and she was extremely raw. And halfway through the program, they brought on a recovering sex addict and his wife and set them down right next to her. And she lost it. And she said, I can't do this. And I said, yes, you can. You can get through this. It's going to be okay. And my focus at that point began just getting her through the rest of the program. She wrote me a letter when I came back to Denver, and my daughter Diana at that point was in her teens, and she had gone with me for that particular show. She wrote me a letter and said, Rhonda, when I was in New York, my plan was to take my life. But when I met you and I met your daughter, I knew that if you could get through it, I could get through it too.
Wow. So what you went through saved someone's life.
Exactly. And I began to determine I was going to be a safe place for women when they came to me. I wasn't going to say things like, you're the prodigal son, you've sinned, and now you've come back home. But I was going to say things like, you can get through this.
Yeah.
And I love you, and you matter to me, and I'm so sorry for what you have experienced. Yes, that was a very precious time for me, and a time when I really was able to grab hold of the healing in my own life and to know that it was being used to help other people as they went through the experiences. I think that at some point I gave up on trying to have life as it used to be and accepted that I was going to have a new normal in my life when I got through this, that things were never going to be like they were in the past. But I was going to experience a new kind of life, and that was okay.
Mm-hmm. And have you found joy in life?
Oh, yes. You know, I wouldn't be honest if I didn't say that there have been incredible struggles along the way. But as I began to share with other people and had a new purpose in my life, I think that that's when the joy came.
Yeah.
And eventually, I remarried. I met a man, Rob Knuth, and he and I had two sons, Andy and Ben. And, our life has been very full with the four kids that we have. Frequently when I speak and I have a question and answer time at the end, some will inevitably ask me, well, how are Paul and Diana doing? And I have to tell them honestly that it's been a real struggle for them. Both of them are now in their early 30s, and they are really just now beginning to come to terms with what has gone on in their lives as children and how that experience impacted them. My daughter Diana went on to get her master's degree in counseling, and her goal is to work with people who have experienced incredible grief. And I'm very thankful for what she has done in her life with the experience that she has had.
Well, and she'll be a powerful counselor because she's been there and she understands.
She has a heart for it, and she's watched her mom go through all of this. She's learned a lot of things. My son Paul has his own business now, and he's doing well, but there were a number of years when he really struggled. And I think part of it was it's more difficult for a son when you have a father who has done these things. There are people who are not kind, who say things that are very hurtful and almost begin to, quote, prophesy that you're going to follow in your dad's footsteps.
Oh.
And so he had to begin to figure out who he was as well and redefine his life. And I am very proud of both Paul and Diana and what they have done with their lives. Very blessed.
You know what's interesting about life? I hope one day we will be blessed with the opportunity to see how much we've affected other people. But I think it would be interesting for you and your children to see just how many people you've helped because of the hardship you've been through.
Oh, that would be great, because you're right.
No.
We don't often see that. You know, there is one more thing that I would like to say, Melanie, is that when I was still in Kingsville, there was a woman who attended our church, and she wrapped me in her arms one night when I was having a very, very difficult time. And she looked at me in the face and she said, Rhonda, you hold your head up high. You haven't done anything to be ashamed of.
Yeah.
And her words were the thumb in my back that got me through the years that were to come. I kept, you know, what a wonderful thing for her to say to me when I was blaming myself for the things that had happened. And she spoke words that really spoke life into me and helped me to be able to face some really difficult times ahead.
You know, it makes me think about I think what I would call my mantra, the message that I'm hoping to share with this show and our book together, and that is that within us all there's triumph, regardless of the hardships that we go through or the clutter that goes along with that or the damage, you know. What helped you so much was to have somebody recognize in you that you could hold your head up high. And I think that we too often, our heads droop and our shoulders droop, and we feel like we're nothing because we've been through something hard or because we're not dealing with something hard at that moment very well. And I hope that that message that you just shared that someone helped you with can be heard by those who are listening, because I really feel strongly that there is a triumphant survivor and a hero in all of us. And the more we believe that, the more we are willing to share that with others. And as we share that hero and that triumphant survivor with others, we help them believe they too can be one, because look where you were and look where you are now.
I feel like I've been entrusted with a gift. And of course, I certainly didn't feel like that at the beginning. But over the years, as I've garnered wisdom and I've learned some of the lessons that need to be learned when you're going through something like that, I have come to realize that not everybody can do what I do as far as sharing about being married to a rapist. Not everybody can sit down across the table with a woman whose husband has been arrested and be able to empathize with her. And so I have not only been entrusted with a treasure, but I've been given really an assignment to be out there and to be there for people who are struggling and who are hurting. I have something that I can share with them, and it would be wrong for me not to share those things. One way that I've chosen to share is through a website, and it's rondasrestingplace.net.
Can you spell your name?
Uh-huh, R-O-N-D-A-S, resting, R-E-S-T-I-N-G-P-L-A-C-E.net. It does not have www before the name. It's just the http://. It has been a place where I have been able to share and write about many of the things that I have learned over the years, and I encourage our listeners to go there and to be able to read some of the things that are posted there. Today I speak at women's retreats, mothers of preschooler groups, luncheons, anywhere that I'm asked to come and share my story. I do that, and not because I want to stay stuck in the past, but again, because I've been entrusted with a gift and I want to share it to women who are hurting. It doesn't have to be the same sort of experience that I went through. Pain is pain.
Yeah.
And there are lessons that you learn to get you through that will help no matter what the crisis is. They're not magical, and it takes time, and you have to grieve to get through to the other side, but you can get to the other side, and that's the important thing, I think, for people to know when they're hurting, is that there is life beyond this. This isn't going to last forever, and there are things that you can do to help as you're on the journey.
And I truly believe that we do become better than we were before. Our lives may have holes in them where we've lost something we loved or the life we had before. But if we look at ourselves, we realize we are better than we were before. And that's something to celebrate
when we're ready.
It boils
down to choice, doesn't it, Melanie?
Yeah.
You know, we choose. Am I going to let this destroy me, or am I going to do the hard work and begin to find healing? And we become strong, you know, where our wounds are at and they heal, and those scars, they're part of who we are, but they're strong.
I think sometimes when we go through hardships, we say, I don't want to be strong. I was happy how I was.
That's exactly right.
But, you know, being strong comes with something else. And that's the word you've mentioned, and I like to use a lot, and that is it's a gift of purpose. And when we have purpose in our life, we feel great joy and enthusiasm for living. And I think it's a kind of joy and enthusiasm that just doesn't exist without that strong sense of purpose. And so even though we might say, oh, I don't want to be strong, it's not even just about being strong. It's about having a vibrancy that comes into our life as we suddenly realize why we're here. And there is someone we're here to live for and serve. And, you know, you're in a position, Rhonda, now with all the speaking you do, and hopefully this show will reach many people to not only help a few people, but more than the average person that lives in this world may have a chance to help. And I don't know about you, but I find I wouldn't trade what I lost for the opportunity that I have now.
I many times say I would never willingly go back through what I went through.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't change who it's made me for anything in the world.
Yeah.
Thanks for letting me be on your show today.
Thank you so much. I am so grateful to you sharing your insights with us and being part of this first Triumph Hour. And I also would like to thank everyone who has listened to this show, because it brings Rhonda and I joy to think that there's someone out there that was touched or helped in some way. And hopefully you've gathered some of the light that Rhonda has to share and added it to your own collection, because I know we are all full of light. And we have it in our pockets. We just need to pull it out. If you have a Triumph story that you'd like to share on this program or would like to purchase a copy of the Triumph book, please visit thetriumphhour.com. And so to close the program, I will play for you the full theme song you heard at the start. The song is called Great Whale and was recorded by the band Sir Anthony's Ghost. Deep heartfelt thanks go to Sir Anthony's Ghost and Michael Hansen, the lead singer of the band who wrote the song, for allowing the Triumph Hour to use the song free of royalties. You can obtain a download of Great Whale by going to thetriumphhour.com
and Cooking on the Buy Now page. You can also subscribe to learn about future Triumph Hour programs or listen to posted recordings at the same website. Thanks, everyone.
Unbelievable appearance.